Cujo's, I guess, sort of in there too. Cujo's Stephen King as well?
Yep.
Seems like they had like a 5-year span where they were like, okay, let's just throw out all the dead animal movies.
Oh my God.
So, listeners, if you go and search for Langoliers Monsters, you know, Google, go to Bing.
Yeah. Type in Google. Yeah.
And then go to Langoliers Monsters. You're going to see, I mean, the best way that I can describe this, that something that I know you've seen is, you know, the Rick and Morty episode with the time guy who was voiced by Keegan-Michael Key?
The guy who looks like a testicle?
Yeah. But with teeth?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what they look like.
Yeah. You're not going to get that quality prosthetic or
right.
No.
That's what we were talking. Okay, that's right. That's what we were talking about.
It was the special effects. Yeah. No, but in that way, because they have to be so practical about the makeup and the mm-hmm. ghosty bits and mm-hmm. The ambiance, all of that.
Yeah.
It feels so much more real. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's the kind of thing that I love about The Shining is that, I mean, Kubrick went to great lengths to make it believable from several different viewpoints. Like,
right.
Like you can believe it's all in their heads, mm-hmm. except for one point, and I could rant for hours about The Shining, but, because they have to lean so much on the characters themselves, it's much more believable because you're watching them go through this emotional journey, and we'll talk about that. All the way down.
And you know, I see that in the book. I don't think they were going for that in the movies, but in the book,
you could see where they tried. Yeah. And you're like, oh, if you know how Stephen King, if you know that the way he writes is very much inside the character's head, and then, I mean, he's like a master at being able to pivot from this perspective to that perspective, from this character to that character, from we're referencing this from an article in a newspaper as opposed mm-hmm. to, like, this person's firsthand account or their own personal diary. He pulls from all of these different places, and that's really hard to translate to screen. I mean, we could talk about Hearts in Atlantis because that book is big, and mm-hmm. it was probably the last biggest Stephen King book that I read. And then they made a movie, and the movie, I was like, this doesn't remind me of the book at all, right. Because all of that book has so much to do with the internal workings of the character, and it's so good in his literature, and the broader story works for a movie, but those two things don't necessarily mesh in a way that you can see both.
Right.
Right up front?
Makes sense. Okay. Makes sense.
So, all right. We should really start talking about this movie.
Yeah.
So we've got Paramount and then black title screen.
Pet Cemetery.
And then every person who doesn't know Stephen King was like, that's spelled wrong. No.
It's in the book. And, you know, they do kind of show it in the movie, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay, so we start at a fish tank on the ground, half yeah. full of murky rainwater.
Voiceover by children saying stuff that's on the grave markers for other pets.
The Biffy one.
Oh, well, that's okay. So in the one of the voiceovers that they do, it's not actually the one that's brought up in the book. It's a different one talking about how his cat cost him $50. And I was kind of frustrated about the fact that they didn't put in this one that I'm going to say to you right now because it was in the book. But they do actually show it later on in on a grave marker. But really, it wasn't because that one wasn't in there. It was because Smucky, he was obedient, was not one of the voiceovers, which was like...
They pan over it.
They do. But that was the one that kind of like started this whole thing. Because it was the one, like, it was the grave marker that his daughter came up with when her cat died in real life.
Stephen King's daughter's cat died. Mm-hmm. And she wrote that marker and then they had it. And then they had it in this...
Yeah.
Intro, and it's really kind of sweet, you know?
Yeah.
And it speaks volumes to the fact that he keeps pulling from his life.
But the poem that is shown is Biffer Biffer, hell of a sniffer. Until he died, he made us richer.
That's cute. Yeah. It's yeah. cute. I was going to say that one of the various children's voices is Jonathan Brandis, who played Bill in It,
mm-hmm.
not too long after this film.
Right.
And it was just, it's just lovely that they use some of these same actors again and again.
Jonathan Brandis also starred in Neverending Story Part 2.
Neverending Story. Okay. Oh, and then we see a skunk.
Oh, it just skitters by. Yeah. Oh, I thought it was so cute that the first animal you see is a reviled and yet adorable stink. What do mm-hmm. they call them on the internet? Stink panda or something like that.
Trash panda?
No, trash panda is a raccoon.
Yeah, I don't know what they call a skunk on the internet.
There's some really cute.
Stink panda works for me.
That's really cute.
I really like this intro because it's very like, you know, you get creepy music and then you get a kid going, oh.
Jonathan turns to me while I'm watching it and he goes, "That's knock off Danny Elfman." And I'm like, excuse me, that's Elliot Goldenthal. Because I immediately Googled it.
Batman, the first Batman movie came out in 89 as well.
Mm-hmm. It is very reminiscent of Batman Returns, though.
If that music, like the da, 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 like the if it would have been shown over like candy making, it would have been the new Charlie and the Chocolate Factory all over again.
Could you imagine if they, like, the parents had seen Oswald and been like, "Let's just bury him in the back."
He looked like it. I mean, everything that comes back from the dead in this film looks a little bit like Danny DeVito, including a top hat.
Oh, that's so good.
Got your nose.
Could be gushing.
Oh, no.
I'm Fred's hand.
Okay, children, look. We cut from this beautiful, like, spoopy intro. I'm sorry, I hate the word spoopy, but when it's something's, like, supposed to be spooky, but you're kind of like, aw.
So it's not spooky on purpose. Because I was like, spoopy? Like, did you mean spooky?
No, there was a Halloween decoration that was misspelled. Like, it was lost in translation. They put a P instead of a K. So it was like spoopy, spelled out in like bones, at like some Hobby Lobby BS door hanger thing. And so now the internet says things are spoopy. Except it's stupid, but when something's cute and supposed to be scary, I think.
Spoopy.
Yeah.
Okay. I like that.
But so it cuts from this spooky intro to a heavily trafficked road.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like creepy. My note was creepy twigs and a roaring truck. Good setup, because without the roaring truck and the creepy twigs, we would not have this movie. I mean, without a lot of things, like, you know, good communication with your children about why death is okay.
Mm. Yeah. Direct and honest communication with your spouse, mm-hmm. with set expectations.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So,
not listening to Herman Munster about the graveyard out back.
Or maybe, you know, he not take him up there at all.
It's a beautiful walk. Well, sorry, we'll get there.
Yeah.
All right.
Family arrives at a house.
I call it Fresh Move-In with Tasha Yar.
Yeah. Okay. So the main character in this, the main two leads are a husband and wife, Lewis Creed, played by Dale Midkiff, and Rachel Creed, played by Denise Crosby. Denise Crosby she appeared in a most beloved 90s show.
Star Trek: The Next Generation.
I was thinking The Adventures of Briscoe County Jr.
Oh, no, she's only ever going to be Tasha Yar to me.
That was the joke. My jokes are not funny, no, guys.
I don't get it.
My jokes are terrible.
Was she actually in whatever that thing that you're referencing that I don't know what it is?
Yes, and we should... Okay, Adventures of Briscoe County Jr.
What's Guy's name again?
Dale Midkiff.
Dale and she were... in lots of different shows at different times as well. It's kind of weird they cross over in like a castle. They're both in a castle episodes.
They're both in episodes, separate episodes of Dexter. Dexter, which has Michael C. Hall, who narrated the audiobook.
Oh, snap. Bringing it back.
But Adventures of Briscoe County Jr. has Bruce Campbell. Sorry. It was a joke. Also, that episode has John Astin in it, who was the original Gomez Adams. And this movie has Herman Munster in it. I'm sorry.
It's awesome.
It's just a web. It's a web. It's like a bunch of twigs in the back of a pet cemetery that if you walk over it, you can go ahead and bury your dead pet and they'll come back. Sorry. Jumping ahead. They also, so Lewis and Rachel Creed have two children,
mm-hmm.
a daughter by the name of Ellie, who is played by Blaise Birdhall. And Naomi pointed out that there's actually two actresses.
Yep, she was twins.
So we're going to not just bring up Blaise Birdhall, but also her sister Beau.
Yeah, except, mm-hmm. okay, because they leaned more on Blaise than Beau.
Right.
They list Beau as Ellie number two at the bottom of the cast list in a way that's really sad to me.
It's kind of shady, though. It's like why would you do that? I mean, why not just put her, like, right underneath her sister? I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you wanted to do it that way, because you're leaning heavy on one, not. But they all.
Well, we'll only really talk about Ellie anyway. Just know that we know it's two people.
Yeah.
And she has a little brother.
His name is Gage. He's played by the adorable Miko Hughes.
Miko Hughes.
So cute. Both of these kids are, like, really, really adorable.
Yes. Also, we're introduced to Winston Churchill.
Yeah.
The cat.
He's Church.
Just call him Church.
Yeah. So
I described him as the main heavy neighbor walks over because, okay, what happens is they pull up in front of the thing. Dude has apparently not shown his wife the house. And he's like, do you like it? She's like, oh, I love it. And then they embrace and Ellie runs off to get on a tire swing in one direction. They pull Gage out of the seat and set him on the ground. And then they're having this whole exchange. And then
the tire swing falls.
It's the rope around the tire swing snaps. And Ellie falls to the ground. She's like, ow, my leg. And the both parents run over. Both parents leave the baby by the car. And he's like, oh, look, I'm just going to look at this cat in this cage. So we've got all of our main characters introduced by the time that this scene ends. So they're attending Ellie.
POV. Of the cat from Gage's point of view, and then POV of Gage from the cat's point of view.
Well, that is really cute.
There's a lot of POV shots.
There are more than this movie's fair share of POV shots.
Yeah.
And Dutch angles that you pointed out, which I thought was glorious.
Yeah.
I did notice, I'll point it out later. Okay, so.
Cat's eye.
Cat's eye.
I had nothing after.
If you don't have anything, you don't have to
Cat's
talk.
Point of view. Cat's point of view. Cat's Eye was another movie in the 80s with a Drew Barrymore. Just horrible horror genre DJ.
Oh, honey.
Wasn't Cat's Eye also King, though?
I don't know.
Cat's Eye was a Stephen King short story, wasn't it?
It sounds like it.
I don't know.
Possibly.
You're going to have to Google it.
Why don't you do that?
Pull up Bing.
I'll be back. What? Yeah.
Pull up Bing.
I'll go use my expensive recording equipment to Google something on Bing and return some DuckDuckGo results for you.
DuckDuckGo.
All right. You guys.
Ask Jeeves.
Sorry. I used to love Ask Jeeves.
We're going to travel back in time to Alta Vista and do a search for.
Oh, man. Okay.
You're online.
Okay, so they leave the baby unattended. He's like, oh, I think I'll go play in the road. This seems fine and unfenced.
Chekhov's truck.
Chekhov?
You know, like Chekhov's gun? If a gun is shown in the first scene, it has to come in. It's like a major playing point later on.
Yeah.
Chekhov's truck.
Okay. Yeah, perfect. Yeah. Well, they lay into you. They're like, trucks all the time.
Yeah.
And it's auditorily, it's very jarring. It's like,
yeah. And I've seen a lot of kids who, you know, respond, you know, they respond to like cars because, you know, their parents really like cars. And so we see Gage just waving at the truck. And I'm like, yeah, I've seen kids do that. But then he walks into the road and that's when their neighbor, Judd Crandall, played by Fred Gwynn, picks him up before the truck hits him. Which at that point, I would be like, okay, we're going to get a fence.
We're going to two fences and a moat.
Yeah, we're gonna have like a guard dog. Mm-hmm. We're gonna make sure that there's like motion sensors and alarms and like maybe a drone. Oh, drones weren't around in the 80s. Mm. Yeah, but I would be kind of like, you know, putting up a fence at the very least.
At least tie your kid to a stake. So they're like, oh, thank you so much, because they had looked up and seen him almost die, and right. And there's a brief introduction. Oh, this house is. And the main accent that Dr. Judd Crandall he has this whole movie is just a fine piece of work. I love it. Like, I thought I'd hate it by the second viewing, and I was mm-hmm. like, no, I love it, and I wish I could do it all the time. There's, and not to tell tales out of school, but there's this lobster, God help me, there's this lobster slot machine.
A lobster slot machine?
Yeah, and I thought that the accent that they used was just like total BS. And then I'm watching this movie and I'm like, oh no, that's how people sound in Maine. That's it.
Stephen King's obsession with Maine.
He loves, you know, be proud of your hometown. Be about it.
Yeah.
But I'm back. I have some information about Cat's Eye. Cat's Eye was 1985. It was three short stories. Written by Stephen King, author of Carrie, Shining, and The Dead Zone.
Well done.
So it's got James Woods, Alan King, Drew Barrymore. You know.
All right.
Sweet.
There you go. Oh, something about Stephen King and cats, man. Cujo is, I guess, sort of in there too. Cujo's Stephen King as well?
Yep.
Seems like they had like a 5-year span where they're like, okay, let's just throw out all the dead animal movies.
Oh my God. Jonathan, oh my God, you're so dark. You just live with that right now. That's a thing you put in my head, and now I have to know it.
Okay.
You're welcome.
So they're like, hey, nice to meet you, Judd Crandall.
Thanks for saving our kid.
That's fantastic. Could you tell us about the path that Ellie mentioned when she was swinging on the tire swing?
And he's like, no.
It's a good walk for another day. We'll talk about it later. And that's it. Like, people are just very succinct, and I like that about them.
Yeah, yeah.
So
they get settled in, they put Gage to bed, and...
I think at this point, like, Dr. Lewis, because he's a doctor, it's an important plot point, he goes outside, I think, to find Church,
mm-hmm.
and he walks over to the tree... And Church jumps out and is like, and yeah. He's like, but they already have the tire swing back up.
Mm-hmm.
On your moving in day, and the tire swing breaks.
There's a lot of inconsistencies in this movie.
There are. That list was so long. I only read, like, I skimmed most of it, and I was like, I'm not going to be like, oh, his shirt collar's there. Oh, his shirt collar's gone.
Oh, the flowers, they minimized somehow in, like, a few seconds.
Yeah, I mean, like, I do like the inconsistencies sometimes, but not all the time.
And like, the whole thing with Church is that the way that Lewis views Church is a bit of... to Lewis. So I guess that's kind of what they were doing with the cat coming out. But here's the thing. Church loves Ellie. He's just like super sweet. He like, Lewis says that when he purrs, it's like really like grating. It's less of a purr and more of a growl.
Mm.
But the cat still like really loves this little girl.
Now I'm a bit of a cat person. And if somebody tells me that their cat doesn't like people mm-hmm. and then that cat likes me, it is, like, the hugest badge of honor.
Your mom has a dog, Tallulah, uh-huh. sweetest dog.
Uh-huh.
And, like, every time, like, both Leota and me are there, she's just so happy. And Leota constantly just, like, brings up the fact that I've never seen her this happy around someone else. She really loves you, Lydia.
I got my hair cut, and I call her Tilbill. I got my hair cut, Tilbill growled at me.
Oh, I know. She, I sometimes startle her, and then I have to be like all apologetic.
Wait, you have to be apologetic to the dog?
Yeah, well, because I like if I startle her, then I'm just like I'm so sorry, because she gets like really like she's like and I'm just sort of like I get it. You had a panic attack, and I was the reason for it. So
it's hard to be the trigger for somebody who's got sensitive emotions. So like the next day, they've decided to go on this walk. Oh no. No, we have the morning scene first.
Well, I think even before that, what is it? Lewis goes over, he like gets scared by the cat, and then he goes over to Judd, and Judd explains the reason for the path. But he doesn't explain it to the family. He just explains it to Lewis. And he's like, that rod. Because that's how Michael C. Hall says it in the book.
He really does.
He's like, that rod. It eats up a lot of animals. Which for me, I wouldn't say that it was the road. I would say it was the trucks hitting the animals.
Nope, you're exactly right. Yeah. So he just over a beer, they're like, oh, yeah, it's Pet Cemetery. And And then we go to the morning scene where, now Ellie, who was super mad. No, she was super happy to be there. She's like, yay, it's great. So she's like, school's going to be hard. Mm-hmm. And she's got these super cute 80s glasses on that are like chunky and clear.
Gage is throwing food. It's adorable.
Yeah. And then, Ellie's like, church is going to get an offer. Oh, during the beer scene, Judd says, hey, you should get your cat fixed because it'll wander less.
Mm-hmm.
So cut to the next day. Everything seems like cut to the next day in this film. There is no really great established timeline because I don't mind counting days when there is an established timeline. There isn't one.
Yeah.
It could have happened over months.
Right, right. Did they go to the pet cemetery before she goes to school or is that after?
They do.
Okay. So I guess, I mean, the way that this movie is cut, it seems like everything is happening in a short span of time.
Yeah. And it jumps and jumps and jumps. So even when you're taking notes, it's like, oh, wait. Okay. So wait, we are talking about, we have not made it to, I'm so sorry, guys. This is the first 7 minutes or so of the film.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, dear God, there's going to be 8 parts to this episode. It gets real fast at the end.
Mm-hmm.
But all of this setup is still rather choppy.
Yeah. I mean, we see that they have a woman by the name of Missy Dandridge.
I call her Missy the Long-Suffering.
Yeah. She's like taking clothes out of her car as Tasha Yar is coming in. Sorry.
With the groceries.
Right. Denise.
Nope.
No, I didn't write it down.
She's Tasha.
Denise Crosby. That's right. Yeah. Where Denise Crosby's character, Rachel, is coming in. And
Are we talking about two different scenes?
The way that I have it sorted up is that we were introduced to Missy Dandridge, who becomes important later.
Uh-huh.
And then there's this weird exchange where she's talking about stomach pains and like, I guess I'll never be lucky because I didn't marry a doctor. I'm not even married right now, which in the book she is actually married. Not the point.
I know, but like Tasha gives her this, I'm sorry, Crosby gives her this like stare that's like, what are you? Even like she gives her such a great WTF look that like
are you throwing shade because I was married to a doctor and you have stomach pains and maybe if you were married to a doctor you wouldn't be suffering from stomach pain?
But we there's that really brief exchange and then they go on the walk because I think the morning happens a day later.
Right. Like they it feels like this is happening like one after the other after the other. So
That's how things happen.
Right.
Sorry. That's really mean.
No, please. It's okay. It's okay. So they go to the pet cemetery, guys. I call it
the saddest walk ever.
Though Ellie seems pretty happy.
And Crosby is throwing an apple back and forth like...
Mm-hmm.
CinemaSins time when he's like, give them an apple to make them seem even more like asshole.
Yeah.
Crosby's throwing an apple back and forth as they're walking down a path in like the most 80s outfits you ever saw.
Did not see that. I did notice that Church was looking at the path and the camera's on Church and then it pans up. Like the first third of this movie, it's like, it's a really solid movie. And it's like the cinematography is really well and there's just a lot of different aspects that like start out good and then it just kind of escalates as we get more and more on.
Yeah, like, it's like a tennis ball machine that's getting warmed up and then it overheats at the end.
It starts smoking.
And it's just right at the end.
And so they go to, Judd leads them to the pet cemetery.
Miss Ellie, do you know what a cemetery really is?
I guess I don't.
It's where the dead speak to you.
What?
Sorry, that was really jarring.
Rachel does not like the cemetery at all. This is like our first real introduction.
She voluntarily goes. Mm-hmm. I'm fairly certain she knows that she's walking to a pet cemetery. Mm-hmm. But her character arc largely leans on the fact that she is terrified of death.
Right.
And she doesn't want to talk about it. She doesn't want to think about it. It shuts her down.
Right. And so she's just sort of like, I don't see how a cemetery is a good thing, even though Judd's like, it is good for them to learn about death.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But she comes across so abrasive mm-hmm. that I'm like.
It's kind of the same way in the book, too.
I bet it is.
Yeah. It's just a little bit more like stuck in there.
So now I think there's a cut to an evening scene, but my notes just merely brush it off saying.
Yeah, because the transition sucks. Like, at this point, I would have had, like, it goes from, like, you know, she's talking about, you know, like, oh, this one's a goldfish. And then just, like, I'm going to scare you. And then it's, like, they just...
Hand me the baby.
Yeah. And then
she doesn't want... Apparently, holding a baby makes the death less scary.
Right. And then there's, like, they talk about the twigs. I don't know. They don't talk about, I don't think they talk about the twigs in the back. The way that the scene ends is the camera goes towards the twigs and then you get like this rattling and it's making it look super ominous. And then it just cuts to Ellie asking her dad about
Is church going to die someday?
Right. Yeah. And like, it's just this very abrupt scene change and mm-hmm. it just goes like it's just like yep we're gonna do a cut like that and I would have done something completely different and I actually marked that on my notes if I can rant about it a little bit
go for it
okay so Rachel doesn't like the cemetery it's like it's really unnerving for her and she grabs the baby and then maybe instead of like focusing on these creepy twigs you go ahead and you have her freak out which I think is kind of a legitimate reason for why she would freak out because of how like stuff happened for her later on in life or earlier in life. But like she is just sort of like she gets unnerved and she's just like, we just need to get going right now. And she pushes her husband to go. And then as they're leaving, Ellie like looks back at the pet cemetery. And that would lead into this next scene where Ellie is talking about how upset she would be if church died.
Right.
And I feel like that would have been a much better transition. And there's a few places where you could have done a better a scene change that would have been. There's another one that I hadn't like really thought about.
Now, you have to remember that the executives cut this movie a lot for time, mm-hmm. so there might have been footage that would have given you a more satisfying transition. But there's no way to know because people who aren't the director or the writer got their hands on it.
Thank you for letting me know. I appreciate that. Because
maybe there's an extended version that we actually have to pay for outside of Hulu.
And I was thinking of, you know, this is like late 1980s. I was about to say late 1800s. Sorry, guys.
Totally.
And so, like, I mean, a two-hour movie is actually pretty commonplace right now. And this is like an hour and 42-minute movie. So, well, like, my nitpicky self is like, well, you could have just added an extra 30 seconds and this is how you could have done it and it would have been better. And, you know, I mean, they probably were trying to get it at like an hour and 40 mark. Because I think like 90 minutes was like solid back then. So
they were probably aiming at a different demographic than what we would now. Like mm-hmm. When we think about horror films, you're thinking people like dating age till maybe even like mid 40s. Mm-hmm. Like you've got a pretty wide swath of people who are going to come and watch this kind of film. But maybe back then it was like, oh, well, this is just going to be a date night teenage movie. And they have the attention span of the length of these cut to scenes.
Right.
So my notes say she's obsessed with her cat dying now. No. Shock.
And she does say one of the greatest lines. It was a line that Stephen King's daughter, which Naomi said is Naomi King or... and this is one of the real life moments that happened to him. His daughter's cat died, Smucky. He was obedient. And then like later that night, after they buried her cat, he heard her daughter, or he heard his daughter say,
she's in the garage and she was stomping on the ground and wailing it out.
Yeah. And he was just like, you go, girl. But she said, that's not God's cat. That's my cat. God can get his own cat. She was just really angry about it. And that was the line. It's like, he's not, I was like, they talk about like who makes the rules and, why does death even happen? And she's like, God, I suppose, but he's not God's cat. He's my cat. Let God get his own if he wants one. I was just like, it's a really good line.
It is a really fantastic line. But that scene that they pan over to Crosby having a moment about it all. Mm-hmm. I'll eventually call her Rachel, and I'll try really hard not to call her Tasha.
Yeah. But
they cut to mom, and she's emotionally having a moment in the background.
Right. And this is how, I mean, when you brought up the fact that it was cut a lot, that makes sense, because this is a good transition. Rachel is putting Ellie to bed, and Church is there with her. And as Rachel's leaving the bedroom, you can see her thinking about it and being like, this does not make like this is something that worries me. And then they go into a transition of a new day.
Yes.
And that's the day where Ellie is going to school, and she says, I don't want Church to get his nuts cut.
Church is in a box. So the baby's throwing food at his sister, and then he throws it at the cat, and I take a deep breath and I sigh, and I'm like, Church, the long suffering.
Lewis is going to get Church fixed, and so Church is in a box, and Ellie's like, I don't want Church to get his nuts cut off.
It'll be all right.
Yeah.
Promise me it'll be okay.
And Rachel's like, yeah, Lewis, promise her.
And he's like, I promise that it'll be okay.
And he
sidebars her real quick, and he's like, I know the way he delivers it is like, it's over the top for the scene. I've been married a long time. I've had to explain things quickly and sternly to a spouse. That's just part of life.
Right.
Like, I would not deliver it in this manner, but he's like, it's only one in a thousand chance. Sorry, yeah. Batman voice about it. But he's like, there's only one in a thousand chance that something could go wrong. But if something does go wrong, you're explaining it to her. And she's taken aback. And she's like, oh, no, me in this 80s yellow bathrobe. My dainty, delicate disposition. We can't even not talk about death. This is part of what makes me so crazy. Yeah. We can't even not talk about death, but we can't acknowledge that it's a possibility at any given time. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I mean, it's not about courage to me. Mm-hmm. It's about not being a dumb.
Well, and that's, I mean, like this whole exchange is like they're trying to mirror what happens in the book. And again, it's a book, so you can like extend it. The book is like close to 16 hours long, like as far as like the narration goes.
So only like half the length of this podcast.
Right. Only half the length. I figured we were getting pretty close. Anyways, after the exchange in the book, Rachel is just sort of like, I don't think we should be talking about death at all. And Lewis is like, but we talked about where babies come from. And I thought we would, you know, have this talk with Ellie eventually. And like Lewis is being very calm. And Rachel is just like, I did not like Rachel in the book at this point. I was just like, seriously? Seriously? And so like the next day they kind of make up, but he's just sort of like,
but in the movie it happens all in the same moment, and so it seems very rushed and it seems too over the top because they're trying to get this emotional peak going that is just, it's not there for me. We're not in with these guys enough. But he takes the cat, walks outside, he's putting the cat inside. Dear Missy shows up. Missy the long suffering shows up.
She's like, he's going to get his. And she makes the cigar.
He's like, cuts her off.
He's like, thank you for introducing that colorful language in my daughter's vocabulary.
She's like, don't mention it. I love it when anytime either she gets it and she just doesn't give a single F, or she like doesn't get it and it's just as good.
Yeah. And then she's showing her stomach pains a little bit.
I could take a look at that for you.
He's like, no, it'll be fine. It'll pass.
And it always does. And she hobbles away with the laundry. And I'm like, oh, chick. So this must be Monday, but I don't know where we started.
I know. So Rachel comes out with Gage and she, you know, makes up.
She walks out. She's got this bathrobe on, and I try real hard not to go outside with my bathrobe on, but it's the closest you get to any kind of nudity in this film. Just saying.
Yeah. And then they kiss. And Cage is like, I kissed you.
No, he goes, well, yeah. But she goes, still friends, Doc? And he's like, yeah. And then they go in for the super intimate kiss that isn't echoed anywhere else in the film. And I'm like, oh, that's supposed to be the steamy part of this. And then the baby, she's holding the baby while they have this kiss that's a little too much.
Yeah. When,
if I'm holding a kid, I will kiss my husband, but I'm not going to be like, there's no tongue, but it's like, and then the baby, who has the cutest voice, they hardly ever show his mouth moving because it's pretty apparent, and it gets super apparent later on, that they record the baby off camera and put it in, and the baby, I think he actually says it this time. No, he says bye-bye this time. You see him say it on the camera.
Yeah.
But he goes, I kissed you. So cute.
He's so adorable. I mean, both of these kids are like really adorable.
Yeah, but he slams it home with cute.
Yes.
Okay, so then it's time to go to work.
And she's like, have a great day. Have a great first day. But they're not going to have a great first day.
Turns out you're in a Stephen King novel. Sorry, guys.
And so this guy gets brought in and we get this like screen. The camera is right on this brain coming out of the head.
The prosthetic is so good. Dude was jogging, got hit by, there's this clamor as they're pulling him into the hospital, which is a small town hospital, so it's not equipped for a trauma center. And so they're like, they're bringing him to the hospital, but they kind of know there's nothing to be done, but town folks are around, and they're like, oh, the jogger got hit by an Eiko Onkyo.
He got hit by a truck.
The same kind of truck that
Orinco.
Orinco.
Yeah. Orinco. That's the brand in the.
It's the only freaking truck that comes through this town, apparently. And apparently they just love racking. You know how like you're in the car and you're like, you point to something and you're like, oh, that'd be 100 points. Like tongue in cheek, you do that. But like these guys are like, yeah, let's run everything over in this town.
What is going on with Orinco that all of these truck drivers have to hit animals, people? Little babies.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, I mean, it kind of, oh my goodness.
So we see poor Victor Pascal.
And he is on a table and Lewis is the only one who's there because everybody else is running around trying to, you know, make sure that things are getting taken care of.
He's got a whole hand span of brain matter showing through his.
This guy ain't living. This guy ain't living past 30 seconds.
Nope, he's not.
And so he wakes up. And he's just sort of like, the soil of a man's heart is stonier.
Lewis.
And this is one of the great moments of the movie because there's this nice pause. There's like a solid 30 seconds of just like you get crazy energy. And then Lewis is just alone with the body for like 30 seconds. And we as the audience have a moment to breathe.
But then the body grabs him.
Right.
Says the line. And Lewis is like, yeah, he's in shock. He's like, it's like his first day on the job. He doesn't know anybody. Mm-hmm. And now he's like having a conversation with a corpse.
The soil of a man's heart is stonier.
Now that's later. That's later.
Sorry.
It's crazy. Okay. So, it cuts to dude in bed. Oh, man. I feel like there should be a sound, like, shwing. Should we do that for every time it cuts to a stupid scene that I'm like...
Without a good transition?
Like, shwing. Now he's in bed and his eyes pop open because I think he hears his name.
Yeah. And it's Victor, the ghost, who is outside his door. He's just leaning on the door frame like, Lewis, I gotta show you something.
I call this scene Moonlit Walk with a Dead Guy. Okay, did you know? I'm so sorry.
Go for it.
Did you know that they originally shot this scene with the doctor with his shirt off? He's laying in bed, but they thought it was going to be too distracting, so they reshot the scene with him in pajama tops.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you've ever gone to Google, and then looked up what Dale Midkiff looks like, he looks very attractive.
Yeah, they thought he'd be too distracting for this scene if he was shirtless.
I would probably be too distracted.
We probably would be talking about this a lot.
Yeah, he was a shirtless guy, which was in Earth Girls, a throwback. The Earth Girls are easy.
Yeah.
Yeah, anyways.
Oh, I did want to point out that the moment that, shwing, one scene ago, when dude grabs him. I think that's where I would put the mark, that that's where Lewis starts to go crazy in this film. Because there's this Lewis going crazy arc that goes through this entire film. And I'm like, I think that might have been the first chink in his armor.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So they're walking through and they end up going to the pet cemetery. They're standing there. And then very dramatically, I call him Pascal. That's what I'm going to call him.
Yeah.
Because Victor, no, he didn't win anything.
He won an open head wound.
Yeah. I mean, brainiest guy ever. I guess he might have won that award. But anyways, he raises his hand very dramatically and he goes, "Don't go over there." Except he doesn't say that. But he's like, he's giving this big warning. And then the scene is very gray, but the area of sticks and debris where he's pointing,
blue light.
Yeah, just sparkly blue light. And he's pointing at it in this very dramatic moment. And he's like, "Don't go over there." And I'm like, oh. Like it's the gun again.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
We have two guns now.
Creepy twigs, roaring trucks at the very beginning.
Mm-hmm,
really
mm-hmm.
good setup. And then he like floats away as Lewis goes into the fetal position. Like, "I just want to wake up. I just want to be a
dog. I didn't kill you. I didn't kill you.
Yeah.
You're as good as dead when you came to me." And I'm like,
you see his feet.
Is that what you're taking away from this scene? He's not.
You see Victor's feet raise up from the ground.
He does float away. I love Pascal.
They all float down here. Best joke I've ever said, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, man, that's good. There's a wonderful transition you point out where he's laying in the fetal position and it blue lights on him and then it turns into a golden light. We fade up and you hear kids playing in the background, morning music, morning.
Right.
The musical sounds of a morning in a household full of children.
It is a good transition because we see him as he's laying down. And then as the scene changes, he's still in that position, but we go from being outside to him being back in his bed.
All he wanted to do, he kept saying it to Pascal. He's like, I just want to wake up. I just want to wake up. And mm-hmm. at one point he's like, "Why do you think you're dreaming?" And then, but he's, Crosby, Rachel, Tasha yells from the other room. She's like, "Are you getting?" He doesn't make any noise. Do you notice? She's like, "Yeah. Are you getting up?" And he just sat up and he's like, "Getting there." Wife's intuition can be crazy.
I just like the way that you with that. Crosby, Rachel, Tasha. It was so great.
Okay.
Yeah.
I've got the transitions that this film has.
Yeah.
And he throws the, because we all do this, right? We all throw the blankets off to the side.
Dramatic reveal.
You don't just slide your feet to the floor, leaving the blankets relatively undisturbed. Yeah. You know, you throw the blankets from the side and mm-hmm. there his muddy feet lay.
Yeah.
And he's like, boom, boom. Boom. But all I took away from this was that I would stab somebody for a laundry chute.
Oh, wasn't it? Oh, sorry. Okay. Sorry. I like had to look like we just watched this movie and a lot of my thoughts are still fresh in my mind. So I'm not really looking at my notes. So when you said, I was just like, I was taking a minute to find out where I was. And I was like, it wasn't a dream. There's this ominous shot of Gage's picture behind Lewis.
Oh, he sits up in bed.
Yeah.
After the foot reveal, though.
Right. After he dramatically reveals his dirty feet, you see his expression. And behind his expression, there's a picture of Gage just like looking. He's not smiling or anything. It's a picture of Gage. You know, when you take pictures of kids and like they're not always smiling because mm-hmm. they're tired and everything. Yeah, it's one of those pictures.
It's just a picture.
Yeah, but it was like that's kind of foreshadowing. And like I was like at the beginning of this film, I was like, there's a lot of really good foreshadowing. But then they kind of just take the knife and dig it in just a little bit. And then they twist it. And they're like, "Hey, by the way, do you see this knife that I just stuck in you?" Yeah, yeah. It just, they draw a lot of attention to it. And I'm like, you don't have
foreshadowing
to.
Foreshadowing should be like
pepper.
Yeah, I was thinking of a different spice. I was thinking of garlic.
Yeah.
Like when you chop garlic and it smells good and you're like, oh, and then you begin to saute the garlic and it smells good. This movie is just like chopping garlic and you're like, oh, I see you got some garlic there. That's going to smell real good here in a second. Uh-huh. And then they put a whole raw garlic clove in your mouth and then they move your jaw up and down while you chew it.
We got to make sure you're not a vampire. So here's more garlic. And then you go to brush your teeth and you find out that your toothpaste is garlic flavored.
Mmm, garlic flavored toothpaste. They put that garlic in a tube for a reason. Oh my gosh. Okay, I want a laundry chute. Now it's Thanksgiving. How long has it been? We don't know. The weather never changes. We only see that Missy's brought back the laundry, so it must be a Monday. We see Ellie changing a decoration from a pumpkin to a turkey. So obviously some time has passed, but there's no real definition.
If Monty Python and the Holy Grail wasn't quite your cup of tea, a plotter, we hope we've revived you a bit as we begin our April reign of wonderful 80s thriller throwbacks. This has been part one of our epic unearthing of 1989's Pet Sematary. Thanks for joining us in that peculiar way where we have absolutely no idea what either of us are doing right now. Hey, this is your audio engineer and Tinder profile that enjoys long walks through grave sites, Jonathan, reminding you that where there are cats and internet podcasts, you'll probably find us complaining while laughing out loud. And that's not just episode 8, that's every day here at Shocked and Applaud. And apparently, it's not just us either. We'd like to welcome Kathy and Heather as our newest Patreon applauders, each contributing her deserved life winnings over to us so we can, you know, advertise. Search for us on Patreon or tag us on Facebook at Shocked and Applaud if you'd like to be part of something not just peculiar, but an absolute treat to produce and grow. Ready for more brainy leaks from our headholes? We'll be back in only 1 week for part two of this slow-burning Stephen King Hollywood throwback. From Shocked and Applaud, thank you for patroning the peculiar.